The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Vivian Glass. And tonight, to coincide with the start of Eating Disorders Awareness Week, which runs from the 24th of February to the 2nd of March, we're going to be speaking both to someone who's suffered from this condition and also to someone who helps people. Please be advised, these radio interviews do contain discussions related to sensitive topics, including mental health challenges. Listener discretion is advised, and if you or someone you know is struggling with these issues, please consider seeking support from a mental health professional or from an appropriate helpline. So more information is provided at the end of the show. Here with me is psychotherapist Sharon Burke of the International Clinic London and also of Bridge Psychotherapy in Hertfordshire. Welcome, Sharon. I'm delighted you could join us today. And today we're going to be talking about eating disorders. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself and about your practice?
Yes, thank you, Vivian. Thanks for inviting me. Yes, so I'm a psychotherapist and I meet with adults for a whole range of reasons: relationship difficulties, depression, anxiety, self-esteem issues, or more mental health diagnoses and support for that. So a range of challenges.
And you mentioned various different mental health aspects there. When we're talking about eating disorders, do you categorize that as a mental health condition?
Yes. So an eating disorder is classified as a mental health disorder, but I think it's probably useful to differentiate between an eating disorder and disordered eating. So the people that I would work with, mostly we're talking about disordered eating, which is much more of it's not classified as an eating disorder. It's sort of an umbrella term used for those people who would have a difficult relationship with food, body image, over-exercising, that sort of area. So it's much more symptomatic of other things that are going on, whereas the eating disorder is definitely recognized. It has, you know, other components and recognized as a mental health disorder.
Sharon, as adults, many of us can be on a diet at any given time, or we might hear a lot about the benefits of healthy weight management. So what's the sort of definition where weight control or interactions with food become an illness?
Yes, it's so difficult, isn't it? Because we also have a culture of wellness and looking after ourselves. And of course, all those things are very good. But there is a broad spectrum. And I would say at one end, we have healthy eating. Somewhere in the middle, we have disordered eating. And then at the other extreme, we have eating disorders. And I think when something becomes our main focus and isn't coming from a place of health or wellness or nutrition or what is good for us, then we can get into trouble. And the gateway, if you like, would be somewhere in the middle. So disordered eating can very often be the gateway to an eating disorder, which is why we shouldn't minimize it really or think of it lightly.
So just to explain a little bit more to our listeners, the types of eating disorders.
Yes.
I suppose the one we're commonly familiar with might be anorexia. Maybe we've heard about bulimia. Can you just talk us through a little bit about the different ways it implements itself, if you like?
Yes. So yes, you're right. The ones that we're all more familiar with, anorexia nervosa, where we're just restricting food intake very much. It's about losing weight, obviously poor body image. And this has a huge, I mean, it's very dangerous, has a huge risk to all aspects of health, but very much food restriction. And then there's bulimia nervosa, which is, you know, binging and purging, eating and getting rid of those calories as quickly as possible. There's also, you know, obesity too, which I think gets overlooked quite a lot, but that too is problematic. Or then there's sort of binge eating and fasting extreme restriction following a binge. So there are all kinds of nuances to this really, but what we're dealing with is emotional pain or very often trauma. That sort of, if we don't have a healthy body image or a healthy self-esteem view of ourselves or our place or position in the world, then food can be a place we go to try and bring some order. You know, it's sort of like food is one of the regulatory processes we have, like sleep and eating healthily. So it's something we can control. And if life feels out of control, or if we feel pain that we can't access, or we don't know what to do with that pain or trauma, and then we can get very stuck here and it becomes a very big focus.
So that's really interesting. You've mentioned those very functional parts of life. Eating's obviously essential to our survival. What comes before that? You've mentioned trauma. How do the two things relate to becoming a poor relationship with food sort of escalating into perhaps that disordered eating, for example?
Yeah, there are so many factors, really. But our culture is one that is very externally driven. There is a huge focus on what things look like, what people look like. There's huge pressure for children and for parents. And because everything is so external and as a result quite superficial, when we have difficult emotions or we've experienced trauma. Now, trauma is one of those words that we hear a lot, and people can disregard themselves and think, well, I haven't really experienced that. We can, you know, it's about the meaning that we add to the experience. You know, what are we attaching to the experience that we've had that we are feeling about ourselves? So what belief system do we now have? If we've been rejected or bullied or abandoned or experiencing grief, if there's abuse, verbal, physical, sexual, what are we now believing about ourselves based on that? And so trauma can cover a huge range of areas of life that many, many people experience. So we really have to understand the whole person, not just the eating and not just the traumatic experience. We're talking about how is this whole person functioning in the world? And if food is the only place that they feel that they can regulate somehow or self-medicate somehow or numb some of that pain because they might not have a safe place to go or a support system yet. So that is where food becomes, it goes from one place to another. It goes from just a normal relationship with food to something we're overly focused on or not really knowing how to navigate things.
From this point of view, what you're talking about here is, I suppose, an element of control, which we're talking as parents here as well. At what age does that start to maybe emerge and start to stick? What influences our eating habits and when does this form?
Vivian, it's huge, huge topic and complex. And, you know, we won't cover it all today. You know, our eating habits kick in very early on. You know, when we're very, very young, we sort of get our idea or our sense of eating routines and eating patterns, you know, but then the research would suggest that somewhere between the age of eight and 10, we have a bit more independence in what we're choosing and what we like. And obviously every household is different. So then children have a bit more autonomy, which is a good thing. And as parents, obviously parents have a lot of jobs to do, but one of the jobs that really aids a healthy approach to food is by letting them explore and letting them choose and letting them have some autonomy there. Nutrition is obviously of utmost importance, but also treats are not bad and freedom is important. And I think that we have to make it safe and make it okay for them to explore. So all of that said, they have a bit more independence, a bit more autonomy, so they get to choose more. But also anything is changeable here. So, you know, it doesn't mean that at 14, we can't suddenly start to educate a little bit more about nutrition and what is helpful. I will often talk to my daughter about, you know, we're off to do something now. So we do need some good food in us to fuel this level of exercise or something else, because our bodies just need that for energy and to feel good and to feel well. But, you know, is food celebrated in the home? What are meal times like? Do we gather? Do we connect? Do we have fun? Is it stressful? Is it tense? Is there criticism? You know, we have to think about the environment that we're in and that children are growing in. What are the messages associated with food and meal times? And How can we really make it positive? Talk about everything. Make it safe to ask any questions. You know, children will hear so much at school. And that happens earlier than any of us would really like to accept, I think. All kinds of words, all kinds of experiences. And then there's social media, of course, which has a huge impact on the ideas that children have about who they are in the world, how they should look, what they should be wearing, what they should be eating. And as much as we can try to protect them, they're all exposed to this, and we all are. So we have to find ways to make it very safe at home, to ask any questions, to talk about anything that feels difficult, making it safe, really.
And you're talking about this family environment or home environment being quite a key aspect to developing, I suppose, our attitudes towards eating and towards food. When you're looking at somebody who's suffering from disordered eating, it must affect the whole family. I mean, this must reach in. If somebody's suffering from a disorder of this nature, it's really tough to watch that. Somebody you love almost destroying themselves, harming themselves in that way.
Mm.
Is it something that you see in your practice? Do you speak to family members as well as patients themselves?
You know, I don't. If it's depending on the extremity of things. So with disordered eating, I wouldn't speak to the family necessarily. That would be much more in the eating disorder area. And in which case, you know, a multidisciplinary sort of approach would be better, so that there's the right medicine, the right nutrition, the right psychiatric support. All of those things would be needed. But with disordered eating, it is so normalized. It is so normalized in our culture, and it is almost, it will tend to come out along the therapeutic journey because it tends not to be the thing that somebody's coming for help with, which is why I like to focus so much on the emotional aspect of eating and what is going on the inside. You know, perfectionism and shame are a massive factor with eating. Why are we so focused on the external? You know, well, usually it's because we feel so bad on the inside that we can't tolerate that distress. So we don't know what to do with it, but we can focus on the external and we can control some of that. Well, emotions, as we know, difficult emotions from traumatic or painful experiences can feel very chaotic, and we can feel like we have no control. If we have a poor sort of sense of self, you know, who we are yet, which is typical for a developing person. You know, it takes a long time to develop into the person that we're created to be. You could say it takes, you know, our lifetime, but for young children or teenagers, or adolescents, it's very difficult to navigate everything. Lots of hormones, metabolism, genetics, different family environments, you know, there's so much going on. So we have to really just have a look at it all and think, well, what is happening for each individual? It's very symptomatic. It's about how we're seeing ourselves. Where is our value? Where is our sense of belonging? Have we had to work very hard to feel loved or accepted? In which case, perfectionism and shame will be present. And that can be driving our decisions to restrict food intake, to diet heavily, to look like a friend, to look like a celebrity, to, you know, to attempt these things. But perfectionism has never made anybody feel perfect. I don't know whether you can relate to this, Vivian, but I always feel my absolute best mentally and emotionally or in my body when I'm able to be my authentic self. That is my healthy place. And that's when my life is most fulfilling. So it's incredibly sad that we have so many people attempting to be outside of themselves or to be other or to be like somebody else, because that will never bring that peace or reward or contentment that they're needing. Really, what we also see is it can take a very long time for people to seek professional help. But actually, that is what's needed. And, you know, if we can work on the deeper areas of pain or struggle, and if we can work on self-esteem and the beliefs that we have attached to ourselves along the way and our sense of worth or meaning or value in the world, then we can really make change in these areas.
And when you're talking about this idea of body image, I can see why somebody, you know, especially a teenager, as you've described, somebody who's still getting to know who they are, they're still almost trying out different aspects of their personality and experimenting. But when it becomes something that actually causes you suffering, you know, if somebody's so hungry that they are just feeling uncomfortable, if they're actually beginning to affect their whole health and, you know, their energy levels are terribly poor, for example, or on the other end of the spectrum, perhaps where they're obese and they're physically uncomfortable and physically restricted about the sorts of activities that they can take part in. What takes that element forward that at that point there's almost no barrier, there's almost an addiction or a compulsion? Can you tell us a little bit about your experience of that?
Yes, I mean, I think people are not going to harm themselves lightly. What is being communicated is that feeling of being very much out of control, disconnected, but suffering. And which is why it's paramount that we can create a safe space in our home to ask any questions, for our children to be able to ask anything, to disagree with their parents' position. You know, our children are not us. And we have to give them room for that, room to expand and become all that they're created to be. And that is different from us often. So the more we can widen the space to talk and to ask and to explore, the better. Because really, so much is happening on the inside for somebody to be restricting their food intake to these extreme levels. So much is happening that is difficult for them, that they cannot manage. And that is what they are communicating. It's too much. And so we really need to come alongside that and find a way in and bring in some professional help and some support, because it's clearly too much. Nobody's choosing that from a healthy place. It's pain.
As parents, how can we model these positive attitudes and these positive attitudes about our own bodies for our children?
I know, isn't it? I mean, parents have so much to think about and so much to do, but we do all hopefully want the best for our children. And our relationship with food and our bodies is having an enormous impact. The words that we use. Now, this can be about ourselves, but our children have been observing us for the same amount of time we've been observing them. And they are astute and aware of their parents, very much so. So we have to think about the words we use, the way we talk about our own bodies, the way we talk about them, but also help them. For us, obviously, being as healthy as we can, having a healthy, balanced approach to food. Don't be overly controlling. Don't instruct them all of the time on what they're eating and what they're wearing. You know, they need to be able to become who they are. Let them be and explore and get to know them at each stage of their development. They are a growing person and they really need it all to be okay. They need some autonomy for themselves to be okay and allowed to explore. You know, insecurity is a breeding ground for disordered eating because we're looking everywhere else for some sense of validation or belonging, being valued. And of course, that doesn't heal us at all. That doesn't make us well. And we're still in pain. We still don't feel good on the inside. So all of that, a lot of that can be inferred in family systems. We have to think about how we're living at home. Remember, you know, connection at mealtimes is so valuable.
In cases where perhaps children are restrictive in what they choose, you're talking about autonomy, but perhaps is there an element sometimes just of natural suspicion of food or fear of food where, you know, it's unfamiliar. We've all had that experience of beige food, I'm sure, with children, where that's what they favour. And trying to encourage them to just experiment a little bit more. Have you got any points of view on that, Sharon?
Yes, I just think the more lightness we can bring into this, the better. So cooking together, baking together. Now, I know that the cost of living means that for some families, just feeding their family is a challenge. And so there are other pressures to consider. But I think making it as light and as fun and as connected as possible so that it feels like a safe topic in our home, so that it feels like something we can ask about or explore it's okay for a child to say no. You know, I think we go back a couple of generations and you wouldn't dream of saying no to food that was put on your plate. We had a very different existence when it came to mealtimes and food. But it's not, it doesn't need to be like that. And we do know that that doesn't help. So allow a little bit of room for experimenting and for saying no and for moving away from things. You know, children with a little bit more room are much more likely to come back to something. But if they're being told what to do all of the time and how to eat, that they're not necessarily learning how to listen to their bodies, how to choose well for themselves. They're just going to be afraid around it. And we really obviously don't want that.
It reminds me, Sharon, of a particularly delightful meal that I had with one of my nephews when he was very small, where he was dipping his tuna in some custard. And he was happy as anything, quite happy. Nobody commented. We just let him go on. I enjoyed seeing him experimenting with the textures and the different tastes. So I suppose that sort of freedom of fun about it as well and not making a judgment is probably quite important.
I think that's absolutely right. Not making a judgment because, you know, remember that they are tuning into everything and we want to make it positive.
Are there any red flags that we might spot though, Sharon, when we're, you know, some of us may have children who are quite restrictive in what they choose, despite all our best efforts. Are there any elements that we should be looking out of? Or perhaps in teenagers, anything that we need to just be aware of that we're seeing something maybe falling into a little bit of the danger zone?
Yes, yes. I would listen to them, you know, ask a lot of questions and probe around. That's just generally, I think. But withdrawal, changes in what they're eating, if they are remote or removing themselves, look for patterns, changes in what they're wearing. You know, they will tell you and things will be visible. So just paying attention and don't be afraid to bring things out into the open and to talk kindly and gently and to ask them if something feels off or different, what's going on and what are they feeling and how can they be helped? Obviously, with eating disorders and disordered eating as well, there's a lot of shame around it. So it can be difficult for people to be honest, which is why we really do need to make it safe for them to speak and share. But I think that we will tend to notice just a change in who they are generally and how they're eating and how they're conducting themselves.
I suppose it's that age. You mentioned 14 in particular. Exams are happening. You know, you've got all of the puberty difficulties that are a normal part of adolescence that people are going through, a jumble of different emotions perhaps and different experiences. Is there an element that can be about secrecy and about actually keeping this secret, having a private part of your life that, as you've mentioned, you control and that isn't something that you want your parents or your friends or anybody to help with because you're not, I guess, at that point recognizing it as a problem? Anybody that might be listening, maybe a young person who's thinking, oh, maybe I am a little bit too restrictive about what I eat or feeling a bit out of control and that's playing out somehow in my diet.
Yes. I mean, if that is the case, I would say don't panic. It is a developing brain and body, and adolescence is it's no light thing. It takes a long time, a lot of hormones. Everybody's body is so different, and we are unique, and we are born unique, and that is where our real superpower is. So don't feel like we need to be like everybody else. But certainly don't panic. Talk to somebody who is safe, if you can, about it. Read about what healthy nutrition is and what a healthy body is. But, you know, I look back and really wish that when I was a teenager, somebody would have taught me a little bit about healthy nutrition or having a healthy self-esteem and really putting into the person that you are, you know, reading a book, going for a walk, building a really healthy self-esteem rather than focusing on the externals. And I think that is still so relevant for young girls and boys growing today because there's so much over focus, celebrity culture, social media, all of the things we've mentioned on the externals. But what's really going on inside is what actually matters in life. And that's actually what's going to carry you through. Build the person that you are from the inside. you know, the external things, everybody wants to look their best, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when it becomes your focus, then we've kind of got off track a little bit. We want to jump back onto what really matters, which is who we are and how we want to live.
And as well, I think having the energy, as you mentioned, nutrition is so important. But if you start to affect that negatively, you know, you're going to lose energy. You're going to feel unwell or just not yourself. So at that point, what would you say, would the GP be an appropriate point of contact? Or how do you suggest people reach out if they are feeling that perhaps their eating habits are a bit off key, or perhaps they're recognising that perhaps their child is looking at things in a negative light?
Yes, a GP would be a very good place to go. Everybody's home life is different. Some children don't feel able to talk to parents, but there might be an aunt or an uncle or a safe teacher. There might be somebody that they can talk to. But certainly your GP is a good place to start. And early intervention, as with most things, is good and helpful. So don't let things linger for too long. Try to talk about it. If it's your child, try to talk to them. Don't allow it to become, if you can help it, a place of conflict. We really do need to be able to be empathic and supportive and nurturing in allowing them some space to express what it's like for them, because it isn't easy.
Sharon, it's marvelous to hear how you approach it with this acceptance and this really sense of growth, actually, and this almost being part of growth for some people, but something that can be overcome, something that, you know, you reach out, you find some help, you find a little bit of support, you can move back into a healthy space and a healthy mindset with your relationship with food. If our listeners want to learn more about your work or they would like to get in touch, how can they get in touch with you, Sharon?
Yes, thank you. You could contact me through International Clinic London, or you could contact me via thebridgepsychotherapy.com. And I'm also registered on the BACP website. So under the Find a Therapist section, you could also find my details there.
Thank you, Sharon. And thank you so much for your insights today, for sharing your point of view on this, your experience, your expertise. It's so valuable. And I think there's probably a number of our listeners that will be quite touched about hearing this subject matter being discussed openly, and for parents, a little bit of encouragement perhaps about how to go about approaching issues with their children, and for young people, how to get help, how to reconsider perhaps this feeling about their body image or about their food, and think about this bigger picture of what's happening for them overall. So I think you've been absolutely super.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and it's an absolute pleasure. And I do hope that it encourages people to seek some professional support and to get the help that they might need.
And as you've said, sometimes people can't speak easily to their friends or family, and there can be an element of shame. So having a independent source, somebody that they can rely on and trust to get really great support from, is so important, so valuable.
Really is. And also, you know, finances are a challenge. Lots of therapeutic spaces or charitable therapeutic spaces will be able to help with that. So don't let that keep parents or anybody away from seeking help.
That's a really good point. Thank you, Sharon. And just once again, can you give us the name of your own practice in Hertfordshire?
Sure. It's thebridgepsychotherapy.com.
Thank you so much for joining us, Sharon.
Thank you, Vivian.
We'll take a quick break now on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for staying with us on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
I'm Vivian Glass, and today we're talking about eating disorders for Eating Disorders Awareness Week. I'm speaking to Molly Leonard, an ambassador for the King's Trust. Molly, welcome to The Parents Show. I'm absolutely thrilled to have you join us. Molly, you've got such an inspirational story to share with our listeners. You've been awarded the Pride of Britain. You've been in receipt of the King's Trust Young Achiever Award in 2024. And you've been recognised for the work that you're doing by the King himself, with your activities receiving funding from the King's Trust. And now you're an ambassador for the King's Trust. As if that wasn't awesome enough, you're addressing Parliament, I believe, this month to raise awareness of eating disorders for young people. Molly, have I missed anything?
There's a lot to me. I think you covered most things. I am a founder of my own CIC, which is a community interest company, sort of non-profit organisation. And it's sort of all intertwined. Yeah.
So, Molly, these are all amazing accolades. But am I right to say that these have been quite hard won? You've not exactly had a walk in the park to get to where you are today. So just to put this into context, we're talking about eating disorders. Can we rewind maybe back to teenage Molly? Can you tell us what was going on for you then?
I sort of began struggling with anorexia when I was about 15. And I was very, very secret about it. No one knew, not my parents, not school, no one knew. I was sort of struggling on my own, in silence, really. Yeah.
And was there any particular trigger, do you think, at that point when you kind of realised that you were having difficulties in your relationship with food?
It's only really looking back that I can see that that is when it sort of became a prominent thing in my life. I was sort of doing things in secret, sort of to get around from eating and things like that. And yeah, so it's only really looking back at it now that I can see that that's when it began. There were lots of behaviours that I was doing really sort of stand out, I guess. But I always was a little bit fussy with food. I wasn't really, I don't know, I've always had a bit of a struggle with food, but that's when it really began.
So was it a case of you kind of felt like, you know, the struggle with food got out of hand, or, you know, what were your feelings around it at that time?
I think it was all the secrecy. I think I was working out in the middle of the night so that my parents didn't know. It was just sort of giving away my food on the school bus. It wasn't, and I don't really quite know why. I guess I felt I never fitted in, and it wasn't that I wanted to make other people happy or to make other people like me. It was more about I didn't like myself and I wanted to change how I was for me. And that was sort of what I did, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult time. I think, you know, that sort of 15-year-old girl, you know, trying to find your place in the world and trying to kind of identify yourself was different situations, I suppose, and with different peer groups. So when you were kind of working through these different behaviors, I mean, you obviously kept it very secret, but was there any friends or anybody that kind of began to mention things to you or say this is maybe a little bit of a problem, or were you beginning to look unwell? How did it kind of come about that you know other people, I suppose, recognized it?
So when I was at school, I was so secretive from everyone. I was a different me with each group of people. And I had a little job, so I was a completely different person, and it was all a front. And then it wasn't until I went away to university, so when I was 18, that I felt like it was like a fresh start and I could sort of leave those people that I were behind. And I started sort of being myself, and myself just wasn't happy. I made friends and sort of I was able to be open with them and just talk about what I was struggling with. I made really close friends, and they were actually the people that got me to go to the doctor in the first place, which led to me being diagnosed with anorexia.
Gosh. And again, a huge sort of transformational point, I guess, in your life. When you went to university, was that a different area? Was that kind of far away from home?
Yeah, so I went to Oxford Brookes. And I don't know if that's what I... Going to uni was always really what I thought I had to do. And I think at the time, I didn't apply to any universities nearby. I just felt like I needed to just get away from everything. So I got an unconditional from university, unconditional offer. And I think that's the only reason why I ended up going to university, which is sort of, it was the beginning of the road to recovery, I guess. So I am glad that I did.
So what was it that friends said to you that made you stop in your tracks, I suppose, and think, actually, it's time I
it's time I went and asked for some help around this. So when I did go to university, it was a case that I was then in control of what I was eating completely, and things went downhill quite rapidly. I'd lost a lot of weight and I didn't feel okay. I don't know, I was struggling with some things and mostly my mental health. So I sort of ignored the physical symptoms, thinking, oh, you're just, you know, just tired or something. But mentally, I think I was crying a lot and I couldn't focus on work, like uni work. I found it really difficult and I couldn't cope with that, being so unhappy. And my friends, I just sort of, they convinced me to go to the doctor and they came with me. And I guess it was a choice. So, yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about that first appointment with your doctor? Did you get a good response? Was it helpful?
Yeah, so the doctor I saw was really helpful. I think my friends went in with me to begin with and I couldn't speak. So they basically spoke for me, which was such a big help. And I think I just cried. And then it was like a fast chain reaction. So from that first appointment, I was immediately booked in for a blood test. I had regular appointments with that doctor, the same doctor that I had seen that very first time. And the first blood test I had, I actually ended up going to A&E because my bloods were so bad. And that went on for weeks. So I was still seeing the same doctor every week, still having blood tests every week. But every time I had a blood test, I would end up in A&E. Yeah.
So at that time, did you start to feel, you know, a sort of sense of danger that you were actually in a dangerous sort of condition at that point?
Actually, I didn't for quite a long time. It was sort of said that I was in denial and I didn't accept that I was unwell because I felt so awful for such a long time that it just was, you know, I can still do stuff because I was trying to do my uni work. I would take my uni work to the hospital with me when I went to A&E and trying to get some work done. It was like, well, I can do this and I can live life. And actually, in the end, it sort of all just crashed and I just couldn't do it.
So tell us about that. You know, was this the sort of lowest point? What was happening for you at that time?
So it wasn't the lowest point then. But it was sort of the beginning of that journey to the lowest point. Really, I think it was when I dropped out of university. So I'd actually had a lot of mitigating circumstances and extensions on deadlines. And I think when I made that decision to drop out of university because I'd been admitted to an eating disorder unit, and I lost all motivation for anything because that's what I was working to. So I had my motivations at the time were uni and the eating disorder. The eating disorder was actually motivating me because I was motivated to lose weight. And when I lost the uni aspect, it was the eating disorder was the only motivation that I had in my life. And I felt like I'd lost everything else and I couldn't let the eating disorder go. So I think I was in the first eating disorder unit for about 6 months and then I left at a higher weight and then my motivation was then to lose the weight that I'd gained. And I went around that cycle quite a few times over the course of about 5 years. And I think a lot changed for me. A lot of bad things happened, which sort of made me sort of sink into the eating disorder even more. I sort of broke up with my boyfriend while I was in hospital in Glasgow for my eating disorder. And I sort of lost where I was living. I was sort of told that I'd have to move back in with my parents or they'd have to register me as homeless. So a lot of big things happened. And then it all led to this point where I'd got so unwell that I was almost under palliative care. And that's when the real change started for me, when life started to get better, when I pulled through that.
So you mentioned Glasgow there, and you mentioned, I'm assuming this is a residential unit that you're in for recovery. Why Glasgow? Was nothing locally available to you?
No, that was the only bed. So I was actually living just outside London, sort of in the Hertford area, actually, in St Albans. And yeah, the only bed that was available in the whole of the UK was Glasgow. It was during COVID as well. So I had to get special permission from the Scottish government, and it took 8 hours in an ambulance to get me there.
And at this point, are your family aware?
Yes. I very much shut them out for quite a long time because I felt like I'd completely let them down. And it was all because I thought that my image that I had when I was with them, I was trying to keep that intact, because I thought, oh, they're really happy about me. They think I'm doing well. They think I'm, really happy and successful. And I didn't want to break that. And I think when I lost that, I couldn't face them. So I did shut them out for quite a long time.
Yeah. And you mentioned about, you know, always being in palliative care. So this point now, this is the lowest point where you're, you know, I guess your weight is so dangerously low, you're terribly unwell. Tell us a little bit about that.
I honestly, it's a bit of a blur. There's a lot that I don't remember, but I remember feeling so unwell. I didn't know what to do. I don't think I could get up the stairs at home to go upstairs. And I felt so dizzy all the time. And I wasn't well, but the thing was I couldn't eat because of the eating disorder, and I didn't know what to do. My mum didn't know what to do because I was living back at home with her at this point. And in the end, she had to sort of beg the hospital to sort of admit me, where it was quickly assessed that I was very, very unwell. And I think I was in the general hospital for about 2 months, 3 months, something like that.
Gosh, such a long time. And so now you're sort of what, 19, 20-ish? Is that about right at this point?
No. So my eating disorder journey began at university when I was 19. So this, when I was almost under palliative care, that was around about 3 years ago, I was admitted to that general hospital. So I was 23.
Wow. And was there a moment, or was it a series of events, Molly, that I suppose started to change how you thought about your own health?
I think it was really like, I just didn't accept that there was anything wrong with me. I refused treatment. I wasn't willing to sort of work with anyone, because I was so dead set on sort of my goal, because I thought that that was making me happy. And that was the only thing that made me feel any better. Well, what I thought made me feel better was to lose weight. And it wasn't, because it was making me feel so unwell, but I was ignoring that.
Yeah. So how did you start to transform? How did things start to improve for you?
So there's always been something that I took with me to these hospital admissions. So I've always loved crafting. Started crafting when I was really little with my nan, and that's what we did. And it was just something that I could take with me. It was quite difficult, but I had to fight tooth and nail to have some of my craft stuff in hospital with me, because I couldn't be without my crafts. And obviously health and safety, it was a bit tricky to get stuff in. So I made do with what I could. And in one of my admissions, I was making things for the other girls on the ward. And they asked me how I was doing, what I was doing. And so I started doing workshops in hospital. I didn't really see anything in this. It was just a hobby, and it was just like something that just made the day go by. So I did this in every hospital admission. I would just do workshops because I liked crafting. It made me feel a bit better, and it helped the others because it made them feel a bit better that we could just have a break, maybe just talk about what we were going through, which was something we didn't really get to do, because it was always like our interaction time was meal times or after meal times. And it was just like not very, it was really difficult to sort of be able to talk to people about what we're going through, because it was really high tension sort of times when we're sort of being together. So having these crafts, it was really great. And when I was in that last hospital admission, the occupational therapist actually said, he sort of introduced me to, well, it was the Prince's Trust at the time, said, have you heard of the Prince's Trust? And I was like, no, I haven't. And he said, they help young people start their own business. So I was still in hospital when I actually got in touch with them and said, you know, I need something to motivate me. I need to do something differently. And I want to start my own business. And when I came out of that hospital admission, that is when I started doing workshops in the community with the help of the King's Trust. And it sort of got on from there.
So this sounds like, you know, things are beginning to look up. You've got some control over something, some important element of your life, and a really important creative outlet. Tell us a little bit more about the work with the King's Trust and, you know, how did you find out about, for instance, the Young Achiever Award? Can you tell us a bit about that moment?
So that was a long time coming. So I'd been working with the King's Trust for, I think, from when I came out of hospital. So I think it took me about 2 years, and they helped me write a business plan. They helped me sort of set up my business and work on things and try things out with me and see what worked and what didn't work. And it was, I think I finished the enterprise program, well, the first part of the enterprise program that they have. I think it was last year. And I actually was awarded a grant from them, which helped me further with my business. And I decided that I wanted to represent them and I wanted to become a young ambassador. So I put in the application and that was accepted. So that's when I started becoming more and more involved with them. And I think it was maybe June or July last year that I'd actually been told that I had been nominated and I was a finalist. So I didn't even know that I'd even been nominated for this award, which is amazing, really. So I sort of whizzed off to London to an interview, and then I didn't really hear anything else about it for a few months.
How did you find out about it? You know, was it an email? Did you get a phone call? Was it a letter? What's the kind of way that you found out? What was that like?
So basically with the King's Trust, I was set up with a sort of youth development lead, and she worked with me for the course of the time that I was there. We're still in touch, even though I sort of finished what I was doing there. But she was amazing. She was the first person I spoke to when I was in hospital. She's been with me the whole way, and she actually let me know, because she didn't even know I'd been nominated either. She found out, and then she quickly told me and was like, ah. So it was a really big shock to all of us, really. A great shock, really.
And so tell us a bit about that role as an ambassador. What are your duties, I suppose?
So I'm there to show people what the King's Trust does and the sort of how they've helped me in my journey, because I honestly know that if I hadn't have made those changes in my life with the help that I'd received from them, I would still be going round and round in circles in and out of hospital, because I needed someone to guide me into a new motivation. And I had this and I grasped it, and they really helped me. So as a young ambassador, I share my story. I go and speak in front of people. I did a 20-mile walk across London recently. That was a fundraising event. So I went and actually did the walk, and then I spoke halfway about myself and how the King's Trust has helped me. And I'm going, I've done a few events now, but I think the biggest one I'm doing is definitely Parliament. So I'm speaking in the House of Commons in March in front of, I think it was 150 MPs and members of the Senate.
And I suppose I'm going to preempt a little bit. What message have you got? I mean, we've got people listening, you know, maybe there's some young people that are identifying with your story. Maybe there's some parents who are concerned about their own child.
Is there anything that you can say from your struggles, any piece of advice?
I think that it's very important not to completely isolate yourself. I think even if there's just that one person that you feel like you can talk to, even if it's not your parents, generally I find if it's someone that's not connected to me, that won't get emotional, because I can't deal with someone getting sort of emotional about myself, because I find it really difficult. So just having someone that is not going to, there's not maybe going to be consequences for what you say. I think maybe I found it really difficult to talk to my parents. If you have a friend or just someone that you know that is sort of anyone really, just at least one person, just talk to them.
Well, it sounds like that moment when you actually had your friends come with you and I suppose speak for you, but visiting the GP was, I suppose, the kind of big key to opening all of this process for change for you. Would that be right?
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't have gone to that first appointment on my own. I really did need the support from my friends that I had. So, yeah.
And if you could go back now to speak to young Molly, 15-year-old Molly, when this was all beginning to sort of come around for you, that when your thoughts were kind of, or your behaviours rather, were falling into these, I suppose, unhealthy habits, is there something that you could say if you looked back at young Molly now, what would you say?
I'm not sure if I said something to young Molly that she would have taken it on board. I think what I would say is that things do get better. It might take a while, but with the right help and support, it really does change. And it may not feel like that, but it can. You can come back from rock bottom. You can come back from anything and just change your life, really.
Molly, you're an amazing bright light, a real source, I think, of hope and inspiration. I'm just so pleased that you've been able to talk to us today and talk about, you know, darkest times and now through to where you are today, a successful business person, running craft workshops with your own business, and not only that, but advocating for young people and talking about your experiences to help them. I feel like there's such a lot ahead for you, Molly. This seems like it's just the beginning. What's next on your agenda? What's next for Molly Leonard?
So I've actually won another award recently within the King's Trust. So that's another thing to add to my my bow. But I don't quite know what's going to happen. I actually went through a phase of thinking that my future would be one way, and then I didn't see a future. And now I've reached this point where I'm not sure what my future holds, but it's going to be good, because it just is. I can't explain. It just, yeah.
You've got good vibes. Brilliant. Oh, well, congratulations on your latest award, Molly. And thank you so much for speaking so candidly, so honestly with me today and sharing your message of hope and inspiration with our listeners. Thanks so much, Molly.
Thank you.
If you've been affected by the issues discussed today, there are local services who can help. The Hertfordshire Adult Community Eating Disorder Service receives referrals from GPs in Hertfordshire. If you need more information on eating disorders, please visit their Useful Information and Resources page, which you can find on www.hpft.nhs.uk. GPs can refer children to the Children and Young People's Mental Health Service. There's also help for young people, parents and carers on their website. You'll find that at www.hpftcamhs.nhs.uk.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.